He said he saw you at his dad's, so I guess all's forgiven. Lucky you, she said. She brought sugar and half to the table and then sat down, tucking her hands under her thighs. That's because Detective Oliphant was there. He and Rule seemed to hit it off. Did you meet Stacy? She shook her head. I heard there was a second detective in town, but I haven't met him yet. They must be going all out. They are. They're very serious about this. Well, good, though I don't get why it matters after all these years. Cops are funny that way. They never really give up. They just wait. Look, I don't mean to be rude about it, but I really have to scoot. The kids will get cranky. Sorry, I'll get down to it, I said. This morning, when Stacy spoke to Cornell, he mentioned a high school classmate of yours named George Baum. Sure, I know George. Why was he talking about him? Cornell seemed to think he was involved with Charisse. Involved? That's a dainty way of saying he screwed her. Oh, for heaven's sake, he did not! George had a girlfriend, a cheerleader named Swizzy Franks. They went together for years, since junior high at least. They got married a month after graduation. Swoozy? It's a nickname. I forget a real one. Maybe Swoozy wouldn't put out, so George got a relief from Charisse instead. Justine made a face. Ew, that's a tacky idea. Why? You've all been saying what a slut she was. Well, yes, but I can't believe George would do something like that. Did he admit it? Not as far as I know, but he did tell Stacy that Charisse and Adrian were close. I was curious why no one mentioned that to us. That's not true at all. Why would he say that? He's crazy. Dubiously, I said. I don't know, Justine. He says Charisse had a crush on Cornell and hung out with Adrian to have access to him. You'd think Adrian would have volunteered the information as soon as she heard Charisse was dead. You said you weren't even sure it was her. Well, the ID isn't positive, but now we have her dental record, so we're getting close. I would have mentioned it this morning, but it didn't seem appropriate in front of Edna's church group. Besides, that was the first time I realized who Adrian was. You can imagine my surprise. I see her at Quorum High, I find out she's Cornell's sister, and then I hear she and Charisse were such good pals. They weren't pals. George doesn't know what he's talking about. Charisse's so-called pals were a bunch of losers from Lockerbie. They were more her speed. Really? Your mother said she made a real pest of herself, wanting to hang out with the two of you. We took her with us sometimes, but she was an embarrassment. Did you know Charisse was so smitten with him? Oh, please. Why would George lie to us? I didn't say he lied. I said he got it wrong. The guy's a dimwit. Besides, even if she had a crush on Cornell, what difference did that make? A lot of girls had crushes. He was the most popular guy in our high school class. But how'd you feel about it? Didn't it bother you? I knew we'd end up together, so who cared about them? I mean, Charisse in particular. She was nothing. A pig. I couldn't have cared less about her. Geez, that's amazing. When I was in high school, I was insecure. You must have had a lot more self-confidence. I wouldn't say that. It just seemed like fate. The minute I saw Cornell, that was it for me. That was grade school. We went to different junior high schools and reconnected in high school in our senior year. Love at first sight? Right. So, really, it didn't matter if Charisse and Adrian were friends, in terms of its effect on you. Charisse could do anything she liked, no skin off my back. She glanced at her watch, signaling time was up. She could have been a shrink, given her skill in silent communication. I held up a hand. Just one other thing, and then I'll let you go. Doesn't it seem a trifle coincidental that your father disappeared just about the same time she did? Justine stared at me. I don't get what you mean. Come on, Justine, you're not that naive. You're implying the two of them went off together? Didn't it ever cross your mind? Of course not. Daddy left in June. She was with us for months and months after that. Actually, it was only until the end of July, maybe 6 weeks or so. What if they were having an affair? Justine laughed. Oh, that's gross. I don't like to think he had sex with my mother, let alone with someone like her. That's disgusting. Disgusting to you, perhaps, but in the annals of human history, it's not exactly a first. I said the same thing to your mom. Charisse was promiscuous, so why not him? Justine clamped her mouth shut, staring at the floor. Agitated, she tucked a strand of pale hair behind one ear. I said, "Look, I'm not making any claims here. None of us have the facts. This is purely speculation." "Well, it's in bad taste," she said. She stood up. "I guess I'd better let you go. Maybe I should have a chat with Cornell. I'm not sure he's interested. He didn't seem opposed to my talking to you. He was being polite. A quality I've always admired in a man. Anyway, you needn't fret because I can't do it now. I have something else to do." Hazelwood Springs on my California map was a micro dot on Highway 78, 10 miles south of Quorum. The town turned out to be so small that I drove straight through without realizing it. I made a 3-point turn using the next convenient driveway and then doubled back. The entire town consisted of a mini-mart, 2 side roads, a scattering of houses, and a 2-pump gas station of the old-fashioned variety, where some guy actually came outside, filled your tank, cleaned the windshield, and passed the time of day. I ended up putting another $20 worth of gas in Dolan's boat, but in return the fellow was kind enough to point out Lenny Root's place, which was just across the road. Lenny Root's small white frame house sat on pylons of raw cinder block, thus creating the crawl space he used to store his miscellaneous painting equipment. There was a flowery ceramic plaque affixed to the wood frame above the front door that read, "The Roots, Myra and Lenny." Lenny responded to my knock. He was a man in his 60s with a narrow, sagging face and heavy bags beneath his eyes. His bushy gray hair was peppered with tiny specks of dried red paint. Over his chinos and white t-shirt, he wore a full-length apron with a ruffle around the bib. He held a wrinkled white dress shirt like an errant tomcat he intended to boot out the door. "Mr. Root, my name's Kinsey Milhone. I'm hoping you can answer a few questions about a former employee. You remember Frankie Miracle?"
"What makes you ask?" "Because if you're working for OSHA or state disability insurance, I want it on record the injury was fake."
"I'm not here about that. I'm actually a private investigator doing follow-up on a homicide investigation. This was August of 69. Frankie says he worked for you shortly before that." He blinked.
"How much do you know about ironing?"
"Ironing?"
"My wife's out of town at her mother's until next Monday, and I'm supposed to be at my daughter's for supper tonight. I need to iron this shirt, but I don't know how. My wife always sprinkles them with water and leaves them in a wad, but I never paid attention to what comes next. You show me how to do this, and I'll tell you anything you want to know."
I laughed. "Mr. Root, you're in luck. You got a deal." He handed me the shirt, and I followed him through a modest living room to the kitchen at the rear. There were dirty dishes piled in the sink, and the counter was littered with additional glasses, flatware, and plates. On the breakfast table, there was a large, broken-rimmed plastic basket piled with freshly laundered clothes. The door to the utility room stood open, and Lenny crossed the kitchen to retrieve an ironing board with a floral padded cover and scratched metal legs. When he opened it, the sustained screech of metal on metal sounded like the mating call of an exotic bird. He plugged in the iron, I moved the setting to cotton, and waited for the iron to heat. My Aunt Jin taught me to do this when I was 7 years old, primarily because she hated to do the ironing herself. I licked an index finger and touched it to the hot iron. It made a spatting sound. Watch this. I took the dampened shirt by the yoke, holding it between my hands, and straightened the puckered seams with one efficient snap.
"That's first?"
"Unless your shirt doesn't have a yoke. Then you start with the collar." I placed the shirt on the ironing board and explained the strategy. The yoke, followed by the collar, then the cuffs, the 2 sleeves, and finally the body of the garment. He watched with care until I'd finished the shirt and buttoned it onto a wire hanger. I handed him a 2nd shirt with the basket and had him try his hand. He was slow and a bit clumsy, but he did a credible job for his first time out.
He seemed pleased with himself, and I had a brief vision of him whipping through the entire basket of ironing as the afternoon wore on. He turned off the iron, moved the basket aside, and gestured me into a chair. As soon as we were seated, he said, "Now, what can I tell you about Frankie, aside from the fact he's the biggest punk who ever lived?"
"How long did he work for you?"
"6 months. Drunk most days, incompetent the rest."
"Did you hire him, or did your business partner?"
"I don't have a partner."
"I thought your company was called R&R Painting. I figured it was your brother, your son, or your dad."
"No, no, it's just me. I put that other R in there to reassure the public. One-man painting company, people worry you don't have the manpower to get the job done. This way I give the estimate and get the contract signed, and then when it turns out it's just me, well, what's it to them? I'm fast, I'm thorough, and I'm meticulous."
"How'd you end up hiring Frankie?"
"Did someone a favor. Biggest mistake I ever made. This fellow knew Frankie's brother, and he asked me if I'd give him a job. He'd just gotten out of jail, and no one else would take a chance. I wasn't all that crazy about the idea myself, but I'd just taken on a big project, and I was desperate for help."
"What year was this?"
"Between Christmas of 68 and the summer of 69. He claimed he had experience, but that was a lie. Worst excuse for a helper you ever saw, him and that friend of his. It's people like that give prison a bad name."
"What friend?"
"Clifton, big guy, had a funny first name."
"Pudgy?" Lenny pointed at me.
"Him."
I didn't realize Frankie and Pudgy were such buddies back then.
"Were when they worked for me."
That was an unexpected nugget of information. I couldn't wait to tell Stacy, though for the moment I wasn't sure what it meant, if anything. "From what you said earlier, I gather Frankie filed some kind of workers' comp claim. Was he injured on the job?"
"Said he was. Oh, sure. Said he fell off a scaffold. But he was working by himself, and it was bull. I got notice of the claim, and next thing I knew, he was back in jail, this time on a murder rap." "Is that the homicide you mentioned?"
"This was a second murder. A young girl stabbed to death within days of the first. Her body was dumped in Lompoc, which is where he was arrested. You remember when he left your employment?"
"June. How I know is because Myra's and my 25th wedding anniversary fell on the 15th, and he was gone by then."
"How'd he end up in Venice?"
"I heard he got a job in Blythe, doing landscape work. In other words, a grown man cutting grass for minimum wage. He met some 16-year-old girl, and 3 weeks later the two of them got married. He was fired from that job, so they moved up to Venice, where he did some painting for a friend."
"Got it.
That other homicide you mentioned, is he a suspect in that?"
"Let's put it this way, the cops have been taking a long, hard look at him. Unfortunately, at this point, there's no proof he even knew the victim and nothing to link him to the crime itself."
"How'd you end up at my door?"
"A drop cloth at the scene was made by the Diamond Custom Canvas Company in Quorum. I was there a while ago looking at their tarps when I remembered mention of a painting contractor on his arrest sheet. He listed you as his employer."
"Nah, he was long gone by then. I was all set to fire his butt if he hadn't quit, which I'm sure he knew. Shortly afterward, the project I was working on went belly up. It was a bad year for me."
"I don't suppose you'd recognize the drop cloth if you saw it again."
"Should. I've used the same ones for years. I buy them in Quorum at the hardware store on Main. You have it with you?"
"I wish I did. It's in the property room at the Santa Teresa County Sheriff's Department."
"Well, you might have him check for paint spots. During the time Frankie worked for me, the only exterior color we used was something called Desert Sand. I forget the company, Porter most likely, though it might have been Glidden. Get a match on the paint and it might help tie the tarp to him. I'd be willing to testify."
"Thanks. I'm impressed. You've got a good memory."
"Desert Sand turned out to be a bad luck color. Biggest job I ever bid. At least to that point," he said. "I'd have made thousands if the complex hadn't gone in the tank."
I felt a minor jolt in my chest. "Are you by any chance talking about the Thule Bell?"
"How'd you hear about that?"
"Rule McPhee mentioned it earlier today."
"Oh, I know Rule. I've done many jobs for him over the years."
Where is this place? I'd like to take a look.
You passed it on your way in. It's on 78, halfway between here and Quorum, on the west side of the road. From a distance, it looks like a prison. You can't miss it.
Chapter 21. The faded billboard on the side of the road read, "The Tule Bell Luxury Condominiums, Tomorrow's Living for Today." The project had been ambitious, accompanied by hype designed to create a buying frenzy. The banner, pasted across one corner of the sign, trumpeted, "Only 2 units left unsold." If true, the lawsuits were doubtless still in the courts. I slowed and turned off the highway, following the deteriorating four-lane blacktop that was divided by concrete planting beds as empty as the surrounding landscape. The builders must have intended to create a lavish entrance, with lush grass and palm trees lining the parkway, but the project had been abandoned long before the plans were executed. Vegetation was minimal. The flat terrain gave way to foothills stretching upward to form the Palo Verde Mountains. Distances were deceptive, the clear, dry air apparently functioning as an atmospheric zoom lens. The complex, which appeared to be a short quarter mile away, turned out to be closer to a mile and a half. When I finally pulled into the dirt parking area and cut the engine, the silence enveloped the car like an invisible shield. In the harsh afternoon light, the partially constructed buildings looked as bleak as cliff dwellings. Piles of trash had blown up against the edifices. The surrounding acreage was flat and still. Dolan had told me that despite torrential desert rains, the runoff is usually swift and results in little saturation. Even from the car, I could see numerous deep channels cut into the porous soil, where flash floods had carved runnels, baked now to the hardness of poured concrete. I got out and slammed the car door. The sound was muffled, as though absorbed by the very air itself. The subdivision was sprawling. Some portions had been completed, others had been framed in and deserted where they stood. Farther out, I could see where a series of foundations had been poured, but the slabs remained untouched. There were numerous tire tracks, and I pictured a steady stream of teenagers slipping through the darkness, escaping from the raw night into the relative warmth of insulated walls. Out here, the wind was constant, a strong, whistling presence that whipped my hair across my face. Behind me, sand gusted across the road. 200 feet away, a gaunt gray dog was stretched out on its belly, lazily tearing flesh from the carcass of a recent kill. It took me a moment to realize I was looking at a coyote. He regarded me without interest, but he did rise and pick up his prized bone before he trotted off. His coloring was so close to the muted desert hues that he vanished like a wraith. I turned back to the nearest building and went in. The windows were gone and the doors had been removed from their hinges. The squatters hadn't penetrated far. In what must have been intended as a lobby, mattresses now lined the walls like a hospital ward. Some sported ratty blankets, but most were bare. Cardboard boxes had been carted in and now served as bed tables for an assortment of ashtrays, drug paraphernalia, and empty beer cans. I toured, checking out the pharmaceutical fair. These kids were doing grass, hash, and cocaine, but the addiction of choice was still nicotine, with cigarette butts outnumbering the roaches 4-1. A used rubber, draped across the toe of a lone high-top basketball shoe, just about summed it up. I tried to imagine the poor teenaged girls whose introduction to sex took place under such sorry circumstances. Maybe they were too drunk or too stoned to care what they were doing or what was being done to them. Outside, I heard a racket like a flock of birds lifting into the air. I listened, struggling to identify the noise. It sounded like plastic flapping, as though a dust barrier had torn loose and was being blown by the wind. The rattle was unsettling, like someone shaking open a fresh garbage bag after taking out the trash. I crossed to the nearest doorway and ventured down the corridor, peering in all directions. There was no sign of the errant sheeting, only rooms opening off rooms, filled with merciless sunlight. I stopped, my senses acute. It occurred to me then what I should have realized right away. The Thule Bell was the ideal setting for a murder. The cries of the victim wouldn't carry 100 yards. If the killing took place outside, any blood could be concealed by turning the soil under with a spade. And if the killing took place inside, the floors could be swabbed down and the rags subsequently buried like strange soil amendments. The Thule Bell reminded me of grand and ancient ruins, as though some savage civilization had inexplicably come and gone. Even in broad daylight, I could smell defeat. I knew I was alone because of the isolation anyone approaching by car would be visible for miles. As for vagrants, they might be anywhere on the premises. There were countless places to hide, ways to remain concealed if the necessity should arise. I retraced my steps, trying not to run, scarcely drawing a breath until I tucked myself safely in the car. Stacy had to see this. When I got back to the motel, he was pacing up and down in front of my door. I figured he was ready for another fast food binge, because I couldn't think what else would generate such excitement. The minute he saw me, he scurried to the car. I rolled down my window. He leaned on the sill while he grinned and pointed to his face. "Well, am I glad to see you. I thought you'd never get here. Know what this is? This is me being as happy as I'm ever going to get." "What's up?" He stepped back, opening the car door so I could emerge. "Joe Mandel called. The fingerprint techs are working overtime. I told you it looks like someone made an effort to wipe down the Mustang. Well, it turns out the job wasn't very thorough because the techs picked up 2 sets of prints, one on the emergency brake, the gas cap, the inner rim of the spare tire, and the outside of the glove compartment. Looks like the driver leaned over to get something out and then pushed it shut. They lifted the 2nd set of latents from a California road map shoved under the front seat." "They managed to get good prints after all these years?" Stacy gestured dismissively. "These guys can do anything. It helps that the car's been out of circulation and locked in that shed." "Whose prints?" Stacy's expression was pained. "Quit being so pushy and let me tell it my way. They compared both sets of prints with Charisse's, but no luck on that score. It's my theory she was already dead and in the trunk by then. The spare tire had been removed, probably stowed in the back seat to make room for her. Whoever wiped down the car actually did us a favor. All the incidental prints were eliminated, and the ones he overlooked were as clear as a bell. Mandel got a pop on the 1st set within minutes. Guess who? You'll never guess. This is so good."
"Frankie Miracle?"
"That's what I said, but I was wrong. Guess again."
"Stacy, if you don't spit it out, I'm going to fall on you and beat you to death."
"Pudgy!"
I felt myself blinking. "You think Pudgy was involved?"
Stacy laughed. "I don't know yet, but there's a good possibility. When Mandel first told me, I nearly dropped my teeth. However, if you think about it, it does make sense. When you talked to Pudgy at the jail, he must have started to sweat. He probably assumed the business was forgotten, but 18 years later, it's coming up again. He couldn't have been sure how much we knew or how close we'd come to establishing his connection. He must have pondered his options and decided it'd be smart to implicate someone else. That's how he knew the little details to seed into the tale. Doesn't mean he killed her, but I think he knows who did."
I said, "He was subtle about it, too. I remember when he mentioned that the body had been wrapped. He was so offhand about it, I thought it was just a minor part of Frankie's jailhouse talk. The same with the fact she'd been stabbed."
"You didn't mention it yourself?"
"Of course not. He was fishing for information, but I never gave him that. No wonder he was so worried about word getting back. Frankie'd go berserk if he thought Pudgy pointed a finger at him."
"I take it the 2nd set of prints wasn't Frankie's." "Nah, what a pisser. I felt bad about that."
"Me too. I just talked to the painting contractor, a guy named Lenny Root. He says Frankie and Pudgy both worked for him in early 69. After 6 months, Frankie quit. This was approximately mid-June. Apparently after that, he worked in Blythe for 3 weeks. That's where he met and married Iona Mathis. What about Pudgy? Where was he?
Dunno, but I can go back and ask. I was focusing on Frankie.
So Root put him in Quorum at the same time as Charisse?
Not Quorum, but Blythe, which is close enough, I said. By the end of July, when she disappeared, Frankie'd moved to Venice, a 5-hour drive. Here I was, just about to swing over to your view, thinking Frankie's our guy, and now Pudgy surfaces, so there goes that.
Not necessarily. They could have been in it together. Pudgy told you they didn't know each other, but that was clearly horseshit.
Yeah, right. Pudgy knew Iona, so why wouldn't he know Frankie? She could have introduced them, I said. Or maybe it was the other way around, and Pudgy was the one who introduced Iona to Frank.
Well, it doesn't make much difference since the second set of prints wasn't his. Personally, I hate to see him off the hook for this.
Well, someone was in the Mustang with Pudgy.
Iona, maybe?
Stacy frowned, scratching at the underside of his chin.
Well, now, wait a minute, hold on. That's a leap we can't make. We're putting Pudgy in the Mustang when the girl was killed, but the prints might have been sequential instead of simultaneous. Did Pudgy know the McPhees?
If he stole the car, it wouldn't matter if he knew them or not.
Problem is, if Pudgy knew Cornell or any of them, he might have had legitimate access to the vehicle. The car came back in poor condition. Ruo might have asked him to move it into the shed or hose it down. Or he and Cornell might have gone out to the shed to sneak a smoke. There could have been all kinds of explanations for his prints being there.
I said, assuming they knew each other.
Right.
I thought about that briefly. Pudgy did grow up in Creosote, which is only 16 miles south. I think it's down below Hazelwood Springs.
That's my point.
But even if they knew each other, it still could have been Pudgy who stole the Mustang. When he was arrested in Lompoc, he was thumbing a ride. He could have stolen the car, driven it to Lompoc, dumped the body, and pushed the car into that ravine.
Why don't we ask him? You said his sister brought him down here after he got out of jail. You have an address for her?
No, but we can probably get one. We picked up Pudgy's home address from the administrator at the Santa Teresa County Jail. We decided to take the rental car, since Dolan smelled like cigarette smoke. Driving south on Highway 78, I pointed out the Thule bell, telling Stacy what I'd seen. As I'd predicted, he was interested in seeing it, and we decided to stop off as soon as time allowed. Creosote wasn't as big as Quorum, but it was 10 times larger than Hazelwood Springs, which we passed through en route. The sign said, population 3,435, but the Chamber of Commerce might have been inflating the fact its close proximity to the Arizona state line. The town had opted for a western look and resembled nothing so much as a cheap movie set, where, at any moment, a cowboy might be shot and sail tumbling from the roof of the saloon. The commercial properties on the narrow main street were all wood-frame, 2- and 3-story structures built side by side, with tall, fake facades, steep outside wooden stairs, and plank walkways between buildings instead of the usual sidewalks. It might have been an actual mining town, or it might be masquerading as a place with a more interesting history than it had. Stacy donned his red-knit watch cap, claiming his head was cold. I suspect that he was suffering a rare moment of vanity, but I could have been wrong. Pudgy's sister's house was on A Street near the corner of 3rd, a small square box set on a square patch of lawn. 3 concrete steps led to a small porch. From inside, we could hear a vacuum cleaner droning away. Stacy rapped smartly, to no particular effect. He knocked again, and this time we could hear the vacuum cleaner being turned off. Felicia Clifton opened the door, barefoot, dressed in jeans and a t-shirt, with a dust rag hanging from a belt loop. She was a tall, big-boned redhead with a blue bandana tied around her head, Cinderella style.
Her eye makeup was dramatic. Both her upper and lower lids were lined with kohl. A fringe of false lashes set off the blue of her eyes.
"Yes?"
"We're looking for Felicia Clifton, is that you?"
"Yes?"
"I'm Stacy Oliphant, with the Santa Teresa Sheriff's Department, and this is Kinsey Milhone."
Felicia closed her eyes.
If this is about Cedric, I'll kill myself. I swear to God I will.
He's not in trouble, Ms. Clifton, at least as far as I know, but we'd like to have a word with him if he's here.
Well, he's not. He went out late last night or first thing this morning. I'm really not sure which. He didn't even leave a note about where he was going or when he'd be back.
Would you mind if we stepped into the house?
Felicia hesitated, scanning the street as though the neighbors might be peering through their curtains at us.
I guess I can't have you standing in the yard.
We found ourselves stepping directly into the living room, which was probably 10 feet by 10. We could see the kitchen from where we stood, and I was guessing the rest of the house consisted of 2 small bedrooms with a bath between. The air was scented with cleaning products. I could see where she'd swabbed a wet mop across the kitchen floor, leaving residual streaks of pine sol. I picked up whiffs of Pledge furniture polish, Comet, Lysol toilet bowl cleaner, and perhaps a soupçon of household bleach.
"Have a seat," she said.
Stacy settled on the couch while I chose a bright yellow molded plastic chair to his left. Felicia couldn't quite settle down, and I wondered if she cleaned to calm her anxieties, as I sometimes did. She'd worked hard to make the place attractive, though the furnishing seemed to be an odd assortment of seconds, thrift shop finds, and discount sales.
"What sort of work do you do?"
Stacy said, trying to strike a friendly tone.
"I manage a dry-cleaning establishment. My whole life's about that, cleaning up other people's messes."
Stacy said,
"I imagine Cedric's been a problem."
"Oh, go ahead and call him Pudgy. Everybody else does. I don't know why I insist on Cedric. It's ridiculous, given the sort of person he is."
She perched on a plastic chair that was a mate to mine. She reached out and straightened a stack of magazines, then idly took out her dust rag and ran it around the table, picking up unseen particles of dust. Stacy cleared his throat.
"Is it just the two of you?"
"Just us. He's been a source of aggravation as long as I remember. Our parents split when he was only 18 months old. Mom ran off with this guy who sold galvanized pipe. Daddy drank himself to death a little over 2 years ago. I was 8 when my brother was born. Daddy was useless by then, so I raised him myself. You can imagine how that went."
"Tough job at that age."
"You can say that again. I must not have done too good a job because Cedric's been in trouble since he was 9. I know I should quit coming to his rescue, bailing him out, trying to get him on his feet again. It doesn't do any good. His only talent is avoiding work, plus he sometimes steals cars."
I said, "What's he been doing since he got out of jail?"
"Same thing he always does. Drinks, smokes, borrows money from me, and lies around on his butt. Occasionally he helps out, but only if I scream loud enough. Then he'll sometimes do dishes or he'll grocery shop. I guess I've been waiting for the other shoe to drop."
"Has he been looking for work?"
"Says he has, but in this town there isn't much to do. There's an opening at the Dairy Queen, but he thinks that's beneath him. I don't know where he got that. He's down so low, there's nothing under him as far as I can see. It's only a matter of time before he blows it again. I don't get how that works. Every time a guy screws up, there's always some gal around to feel sorry for him. In this case, it's me."
"I know one of those," I said, thinking of Iona.
"It's guilt," Stacy said.
"Is that it? Well, I guess. He always seems so sincere. Every time I look at him, I see him at 9. He got caught when he stole 2 silver picture frames from a neighbor lady across the street. What in hell did he want with 2 silver picture frames? Then he cried like a baby and swore up and down he'd never do it again."
"How long did that last?"
"Oh, about a month. I forget what he stole next, something equally useless. I can lecture him all I like, scream and yell. He knows exactly what to say to reel me in again. He's not dumb by any stretch, but he's lazy as all get out. He does whatever works in the moment without a thought in his head about the consequence. I'm sorry. I don't know how I got off on that. You want me to have him call you when he gets back?"
If you would, that'd be great,
Stacy said, taking out a ballpoint pen.
You have a piece of paper, I can give you the number.
You can write it on the cover of that Cosmopolitan. I never throw those out. Stacy jotted down the name of our motel, the number, and our two room numbers on the cover of the magazine. You might write your names down so I don't forget, she said, meaning that she already had. Stacy scribbled our names, then clicked his pen and tucked it away.
When he goes out, do you have any idea where? We'll be happy to scout around and see if we can find him ourselves.
There's a tavern, just a little hole in the wall, over on Vine. You might try there. I can't think where else he might be, unless he drove into Blythe.
Who's he hang out with?
No one that I know. He's been in jail so many times he doesn't have many friends left. He did get a couple of phone calls Thursday night. The first I don't know about, he took that himself. The second time I answered, and it turned out to be a woman he dated years ago. Not Iona Mathis, I said. That's exactly who. You know her? I met her a few days ago. She's nice. I like her. Too bad he didn't end up with her. I hear she married someone else. Why'd she call him? I don't know. But she must have been pissed because I heard him backpedaling like crazy, swearing up and down he didn't do whatever it was she was so aggravated about. Then some guy got on the line and it started all over again. Frankie Miracle? Could be. I think so. I wasn't paying that close attention. Phone's in the kitchen. The call came during my favorite TV show, so after a few minutes of his yammering, I got up and shut the door. After the call, he didn't say anything about going out last night. No, but then it's not like he tells me half of what he does. You think he might have gone off to meet Iona? Oh, God, no. I sincerely hope not. As mad as she was, he'd be smart to keep his distance. I don't like the sound of that, I said when Stacy and I were in the car again. Why don't you find a gas station and we'll see if there's a payphone?
Who are you going to call?
Annette, up in Peaches, Iona's mom. There were two gas stations on the main drag, a Chevron at the corner of First and Vine, and an Argo station at the corner of Hollywood and Vine. Somebody had a sense of humor here, at any rate. Stacy pulled in at the Argo. The two of us emptied our pockets and came up with a handful of change. He waited in the car while I dialed directory assistance and got the number for the Moonlight Cafe. Within minutes, I had Annette on the other end of the line. Hi, Annette. This is Kinsey Milhone. Lieutenant Dolan and I remember you, she said. How's that lieutenant? I forget his first name. Conrad. People call him Con. As a matter of fact, he had a heart attack yesterday. He's in the hospital in Quorum. Well, forevermore. I'm so sorry to hear that. The poor man. How's he doing? Well, he's got good doctors, and they seem to think he'll be okay. Thank goodness. You tell him I intend to keep him in my prayers. I'll do that. In the meantime, I have a question for Iona. Is she working today? Honey, don't I wish. She left Peaches shortly after you did and drove straight to Santa Teresa. She called later that same day to say she was at Frank's. I can't believe my own flesh and blood, so dumb. I told her to stay away from him, but would she listen? Of course not. How'd that happen? Last I heard, he didn't even know where she was. Baby, that was daydreaming on my part. Now I find out she was in touch with him the whole time he was in prison. They're on the phone with each other just about every day. What sent her running to him? You don't know how protective she is where he's concerned. She's worse than a mama bear. She's sure he didn't have anything to do with that other poor girl's death. You know, the one you were here asking about? If he did, she'd be first in line volunteering an alibi for him. Could she do that? Do what? Provide him an alibi for the 2 days after Kathy Lee's death? She was awfully vague on that score. Iona's convinced there's an explanation, but so far I haven't heard a word of it. I think that's why she went, to find out where he was for that 2 days. I know she was fretting about the quarry where the girl was dumped. I held the receiver out and squinted at the mouthpiece. Why would Iona fret about that?
Oh, she knows the place well. She used to play there as a kid. She has a couple cousins. This is my sister's two kids. Iona stayed with them every summer for 2 weeks. They'd ride their bikes over to the quarry and have rock fights.
In Lompoc?
What did I just get through saying to you?
Why didn't you tell Lieutenant Dolan?
I must not have been thinking, or I'd have spoken right up.
Are you sure it's the same one? There must be others in the area.
I guess that's what Iona's trying to find out.
Did she mention Pudgy at all?
In regard to what?
I'm wondering if she said anything to Frankie about him.
Well, she must have. You know Pudgy and Frankie were in jail together right around that same time. If anybody pointed a finger, it almost had to be him. She figures Pudgy threw Frankie's name in the hat, hoping to make some kind of deal for himself.
Oh, jeez. That's not true. There wasn't any deal, I said. Look, do me a favor. If she gets in touch, will you have her call me? I'm in Quorum at the Ocean View Motel, room 125.
I don't expect to hear from her, but if I do, I'll be happy to tell her. Of course, you're closer to her than I am.
Excuse me?
Well, hon, she's in creosote. I told you that. After she left Santa Teresa, she went looking for Pudgy to see if she could straighten this out.
Did Frankie come with her?
Lord, I don't know. I hope not. She never said.
I didn't actually groan, but I probably should have. Let's don't worry about that now. Thanks, Annette. You've been a big help.
Honey, you tell Lieutenant Dolan I'm sending him a big old sloppy kiss.
I'll do that. Just please have Iona call me if you hear from her. You don't know where she's staying.
Of course not. I'd have said if I did.
Great. I thought I better check in case I missed that part. Chapter 22. We cruised Vine, which was the main street of Creosote, and all of 10 blocks long. There was only the one tavern, done up in the ubiquitous Western theme. We parked and went in, pausing to get our bearings. Low ceilings, supported by heavy beams, a wooden floor dense with sawdust, rough-hewn log walls chunked with stucco or its equivalent. There was a long, polished mahogany bar, with the requisite brass foot railing, 8 tables with captain's chairs, and a foosball table. The place was deserted, so it didn't take long to figure out that Pudgy wasn't there. At one end of the bar, there was an old Orange Julius machine with a perpetual fountain of juice laving the square glass tank. Behind the bar, there was a rotisserie where old-fashioned hot dogs on skewers circled past a heat source, throwing off an irresistible cheap scent. Stacy and I made a beeline for the bartender, ordering and consuming 2 hot dogs each, decorated with a squiggle of mustard and piled high with a nasty sweet pickle relish and onions minced so fine our eyes were watering. Neither of us said a word until the last bite of bun had been munched and swallowed. I was gratified to hear Stacy making the same low whimpering sounds that accompanied most of my meals. He chased his lunch down with a Coke and then used a paper napkin to scrub his mouth and fingers.
I'll be burping weenies for the rest of the day, but it's worth it. Don't know how I worked up such an appetite.
Well, Stacy, we haven't eaten since noon, and it's after 3 o'clock.
Can I get you anything else?
The bartender was a man in his late 50s with an egg-shaped face, balding head, and a gap between his 2 front teeth. Stacy said,
We're looking for Pudgy Clifton. His sister Felicia thought he might be here.
Haven't seen him today. He usually shows up at 11 when we open the place. He'll be in later. Happy hour for sure. He never misses a chance to get his 2-for-1.
When he comes in, would you have him get in touch with us? We're out running around, but he can reach us later at the Ocean View Motel in Quorum.
Stacy made a note on a paper napkin, which the bartender set on the ledge of liquor bottles behind him. I waited while Stacy paid for lunch, my second, his third, and then we returned to the car. Heading north again on Highway 78, I pointed out the hazy outlines of the Thule Bell in the distance, off to the left. You want to do the tour now or come back?
No time like the present.
Stacy turned into the paved four-lane entrance, noting as I had its deteriorating state. We drove the mile and a half, the desert stretching out on every side of us. When we reached the complex, he parked and we got out. It was still afternoon and the sun overhead was like a pitiless spotlight, revealing every crack and flaw in the abandoned site. Somehow, in my memory, I'd tidied it up a bit, forgetting the garbage and blowing sand, the gaping windows and ruts in the surrounding dirt parking area. I sensed movement and shifted my gaze. I reached out and put a hand on Stacy's arm, and both of us stood stock still. Two coyotes had appeared at a trot. Both were pale gray and scrawny, bony-legged, taller than the average German shepherd, but with the same prominent ears. The first coyote stopped and regarded us with a certain leisurely arrogance. These were desert coyotes, smaller than the ones we saw in Santa Teresa. There, when the drought years eliminated small rodents and ground game, coyote packs were forced down out of the foothills into urban neighborhoods. I'd heard them calling to one another, chilling, high-pitched yelps, when they'd cornered their quarry and were closing in on the kill. I'd seen countless handmade signs stapled to telephone poles, usually displaying photographs and phone numbers, offering plaintive appeals for the return of lost cats and small dogs. I knew where they were. In dawn light, in my travels around town, I'd spotted the occasional lone coyote crossing the road with a bundle in its jaws. Out here in the desert, where the heat was extreme and even less rain fell, coyotes ate anything. Lizards, insects, carrion, snakes. The second coyote had trotted on, but now circled back to the first. This must have been the female of the pair, her sides rounded by a litter of pups. The two animals stared up at us with an eerie intelligence. I was aware of their cold yellow eyes and the fathomless round black pupils. I had no sense that they feared us. This was their territory, sparse and untamed, and their survival rates would always be better than ours out here. Stacy clapped his hands, and the two continued on the road at the same unhurried pace. He turned and watched them, as I did, until they disappeared from view. The wind picked up. Despite the sun and even in my bomber jacket, I found myself huddled against the cold. Let's go inside before I freeze to death. We wandered the empty corridors. With Stacy close by, I was willing to venture farther afield. We explored together at first and then separated. While he inspected the partially completed condominium next door, I stumbled across an unfinished wood staircase and picked my way carefully to the second floor. I crossed to a wide, frameless window and looked out at the land, mile after mile of scrub dotted with tumbleweeds. Again, the sound of rapidly flapping plastic. I leaned out, peering to my right. At ground level, I could see a cloudy corner of the sheeting dance forward and back from beneath a pile of rocks. Ghost stories originate from such phenomena. I was surprised the locals hadn't already generated legends about the place. Across the way, Stacy emerged from the adjacent building into full sunlight. He saw me and waved. I returned his wave, watching as he rounded the corner of that building and disappeared again. I left the window and joined him down below. It was close to 4 o'clock when we pulled in at the motel. I felt we'd done enough for one day, and I voted for a break. Stacy said he'd go back to the hospital and spend time with Dolan. Once he dropped me at the room, I changed into my sweats and sockinies and went jogging. My last run had been Wednesday before Dolan and I left town. As this was now Saturday, I thought it was high time I did something in my own behalf. For once, I was happy about the chilly desert air. Humidity was low, and I managed to do the entire 3 miles scarcely breaking a sweat. Back again, I found the message light blinking on the face of my phone. I dialed 6, and the operator told me I had a message from Betty Puckett. I wrote down the name and number, but it took me a beat to remember her. The guidance counselor/typing teacher at Lockerbie Alternative High School. I thought about showering, but decided to place the call before I got myself cleaned up. When she picked up on her end, she was already sounding most annoyed with me.
I'm sorry to be peevish, but I've called you 3 times and I expected a call back.
Mrs. Puckett, my apologies, but this is the first and only message I've ever had from you. When did you call before?
2 times yesterday afternoon and again first thing this morning.
Oh, it must be the desk clerk. She's terrible with messages and just about everything else. Believe me, I'd have called you if I'd known.
Well, I suppose these things happen, she said, mollified. Patsy Markham called me shortly after you left the office yesterday. I don't think I can help, but Patsy thought I should get in touch.
We've actually made some progress since I talked to her. It now appears possible our murder victim is a girl named Charisse Quinn. Do you remember her?
That name doesn't ring a bell. When was she at Lockerbie?
This would have been April or May of 1969. She started at Quorum High in March, but she got expelled fairly soon, from what I've heard. She must have transferred to Lockerbie close to the end of the school year.
I was afraid you'd say that. I was out during that period on medical leave. I know, because I went back through my records and checked my calendar for that year. Otherwise, I'd have done the intake interview.
So you didn't meet with her?
I didn't. I wish I could help.
I do, too. We've been hearing a lot about her, but most of it's derogatory. I was hoping to get something more objective from you.
Sorry to disappoint. Was the family local?
Not as far as I know. I took a moment to explain the situation with Medora Sanders and her fostering of Charisse.
I do know the Sanders, or I should say I did. I'm not familiar with Medora's current circumstances, but in those days she had a serious drinking problem.
How much do you know about Wilbur?
Well, I knew him to speak to. We went to the same church, at least when Medora was sober enough to attend.
She says he left her mid-June and she hasn't heard from him since. We've been wondering if there's a link between Charisse's disappearance and his.
Oh, I wouldn't think so. He did run off with someone, but it wasn't her. This was a woman he worked with at Sears.
How do you know that?
Rumors were flying. That's all anybody ever talked about.
I can't believe Justine and Medora didn't know, I said.
I guess no one was willing to be the bearer of bad news. I heard just recently, and I forget now who told me, that Wilbur married that woman and he's living in Sacramento under a fictitious name. Sandy Wilberson, or some variation.
Really? Oh, that's interesting, because Medora thinks he's dead.
To all intents and purposes, he is.
One more thing while I have you on the line. This is probably a long shot, but I'm wondering if you remember a kid named Cedric Clifton. He's originally from Creosote, but he's been in trouble since he was 9, and he might well have ended up at Lockerbie.
Yes, I know Cedric, though it's odd you should ask. He was a student of ours in 1968, a year before the period you were talking about.
What's odd about that?
Well, you mentioned the Sanders. He dated their daughter. He was older than she, probably 19 or so to her 16.
Justine and Pudgy Clifton? I don't think so. Didn't she date Cornell McPhee?
Yes, but she dated Cedric first. The two of them broke up after she started dating Cornell and set her cap for him, as they used to say. They were both in my daughter's class at Quorum.
Oh, for heaven's sake, I said. What's the deal around here? Everybody knows everybody. Betty Puckett laughed.
Welcome to small-town America. What else can I tell you about Cedric?
Did he ever do time for Grand Theft Auto?
Oh, sure, among other things, she said.
Such as what?
Theft by deception, forgery, bad checks.
Not violent crime.
Not while he was at Lockerbie. I have no way of knowing what he's done since then.
Thanks. You've been a big help. Sorry you had so much trouble getting through to me, I said. I showered and washed my hair, wishing I could rinse off my confusion as easily with the water running down the drain. All the little bits and pieces, the subterranean links. It was like looking for a pattern in the Milky Way. After I was dressed, I sat down at the desk where I hauled out a pack of index cards and started making notes. Once I jotted down everything that seemed relevant, I organized the cards in roughly chronological order, set the Smith Corona on the desk, and typed up a report. Both Stacy and Dolan were capable of doing the same work, and would have done so if pressed, but I was eager to see how the facts would arrange themselves. I could see the connections form and separate, though they made no particular sense. Pudgy working with Frankie, Frankie married to Iona, Pudgy dating Justine before her marriage to Cornell. Iona had grown up in the same town as Pudgy and had hung out with him in her youth. Cornell's sister, Adrian, had been friends with a murdered girl, always assuming, of course, that Charisse and Jane Doe were one and the same. Then there were Pudgy's fingerprints on the stolen car. Now that was an interesting development. I sat and stared at the cards, thinking about the players. It occurred to me that in 1969, I was only 2 years older than these kids were then. I'd fumbled my way through high school without once achieving academic excellence. I was never elected to class office, never played a sport, and never participated in extracurricular activities. I wasn't a member of the band, the pep squad, or the chorus. Mostly, I walked around feeling glum and disenfranchised. I made unremarkable to mediocre grades, smoked dope, and hung out with other low sorts, undistinguished and unnoticed. Had I attended Quorum High School, Pudgy would more likely have been a friend of mine than Justine or Cornell. While Cornell was no longer a varsity hero, he was a decent, hard-working guy with a wife and kids to support. Justine was a full-time wife and mom. Adrian now worked as an administrative assistant in the very high school she'd attended. And Pudgy was still busy getting sent to jail. As for me, I was now a more or less respectable law-abiding citizen who shunned illegal drugs and refused to place burning objects of any sort between my lips. I wondered how Charisse had figured into the grand scheme of things. At least the rest of us had enjoyed the option of making better choices in later life than we'd made in our teens. All of her opportunities had ended in 1969. And one of the decisions she'd made had been her last. Once I finished typing the report, I sat and shuffled the cards, playing the little game I always play. I laid them out randomly, then, like a hand of solitaire, watching to see how events would look when the chronological order became jumbled. The truth isn't always immediately apparent, especially when it comes to murder. What appears to be a logical series of incidents might look entirely different when the sequence is turned on its head. The police are always working backward from the homicide itself to events leading up to the fatal blow. Except for random killings, which have become increasingly common these days, murders happen for a reason. There is motive. Always motive. In 9 cases out of 10, if you know why something happens, you'll know who as well. I sorted through the cards again just to see if I'd missed anything. Of course, I'd forgotten to go back to Medora and ask why she'd waited a week to file the missing persons report on Charisse. I placed that card on top of the stack, turning it upside down as a reminder to myself before I secured them with a rubber band. The point was minor, and there was probably an explanation, but it was still a question that needed covering. At 5, I tossed the pack of index cards in the drawer on top of the murder book, stacked the pages of my typed report, tucked them in a folder, and drove them to the local print shop where I had 2 copies made. On my way back to the motel, driving east on Main Street, I caught a glimpse of Adrian Richards heading for the local supermarket. She just parked her car and was walking from the side lot to the front entrance. I braked, glancing belatedly in the rearview mirror, in hopes the car behind me wouldn't climb up my tailpipe. I made a hard left-hand turn to the annoyance of several motorists, one of whom shook his fist at me and mouthed a naughty word. I made a sheepish gesture and blew him a kiss. I parked and went in. I did a quick walking survey, canvassing the store aisle by aisle. I finally spotted her in the produce section, grocery list between her teeth while she picked through a display of cantaloupes. In her cart, she had a plastic basket of cherry tomatoes, 2 bunches of green onions, and a cauliflower that looked like a brain wrapped in cellophane. I said, "Hi, I've been hoping to talk to you, but I didn't know how to get in touch. What's your husband's first name?" "Peter. We're divorced. He's in Reno." Mind if I tag along? Fine with me, she said. She was wearing jeans, tennis shoes, and a twin set of smoky blue cashmere. Her hair was pulled back at the nape of her neck, secured with a barrette. She selected a cantaloupe, sniffed it, and then tucked it in her cart. She moved on, pausing at the dairy case to check the expiration date on a carton of skim milk, which she then placed in her cart.
What can I help you with?
Well, I'm curious. When I showed up in the office at Quorum High, didn't it occur to you I might have been talking about Charisse?
Not at all. Why would it? She's been gone for years.
I heard you were good friends.
I don't know about good friends. We hung out together some.
Did she say anything to you about leaving town?
I didn't even know she was gone.
It's not like I saw her every day.
But once you figured it out, didn't you worry about her?
Not particularly. I figured she could take care of herself.
Did you ever hear from her again?
No, but I didn't expect to. That's not how it was. I was a couple of years younger, and we didn't have much in common. I've lost touch with a lot of classmates I was closer to than her.
Such is life.
You don't seem upset about the murder. Doesn't that bother you?
Look, I'll be honest. I'm sorry for what happened, but I'm not sad. Why would I be? I knew her 4 months at best.
Tell me about the friendship, such as it was.
I don't know what to say. I thought she was funny. She didn't care what she said, and she really didn't care what other people thought. I was feeling rebellious. She did things I didn't have the nerve to do. I was a good girl. She was bad. I guess opposites attract.
We turned left, ambling down an aisle stocked with canned vegetables, dried pasta, white and brown rice, and dried legumes. She picked up a package of lentils. I said, "Do you know Pudgy Clifton?"
"Sure. He dated Justine."
"How long did they go together?"
"A year or so, less.
Personally, I thought he was a bum, but she liked him. Even after they broke up, they stayed friends."
"He seems like an odd choice for her."
"You should have seen the guy I dated. Talk about a misfit."
"Did Pudgy know Cornell?"
"We all knew each other."
"What about Frankie Miracle and Iona Mathis?"
"I've heard the names, but I don't know either one."
"Did Pudgy spend much time at your house?"
She seemed mildly baffled.
"A fair amount. What makes you ask?"
"Do you think he could have stolen the Mustang from your father's shop?" I could see her consider.
"It's possible. He stole other cars back then."
She moved over to the shelves, choosing a can of tomato sauce and 2 cans of pork and beans.
"Did you suspect him at the time?"
"It might have crossed my mind."
"Did you ever mention that to your dad?"
"No. I didn't see Pudgy do it, so why get him in trouble when I didn't know for sure? I figured he was trying to impress Justine."
"Hadn't they broken up by then?"
"Well, yes, but he was hoping to get her back."
"Did she know he took the car?"
"I don't even know that. It's just a guess on my part. I don't understand what you're getting at."
"I think he not only stole the car, but drove up to Lompoc with Charisse. I didn't mention dead in the trunk."
"So what?"
"You never asked him if he knew what happened to her?"
"I'm sure if he'd known something, he would have spoken up."
"Didn't anybody seem concerned?"
"Not really. Medora reported her missing, so we all assumed the police would take care of it."
"I'm sorry if that sounds mean."
By now, she'd turned onto an aisle lined on both sides with freezer cases, ice creams, frozen pies, pizzas, and bags of frozen vegetables. Adrian opened a glass door and removed a bag of baby peas. I studied her with puzzlement.
"Why do I have the feeling you know something you're not telling me?"
"I'm sure I know lots of things I haven't told you."
"About Charisse."
"I don't want to make trouble. I told you that before."
"Who would you be making trouble for?"
"I'm speaking in generalities, not about anyone specific."
"Let's hope that's true. Thanks for your time."
She moved on, and I remained where I was, watching the efficiency with which she went about her business. I stopped by the motel. Stacy's car was gone. He hadn't left me a note, so I figured I'd catch him later. I drove on over to Quorum General, where I found Dolan sleeping, his dinner tray pushed to one side. I tiptoed to his bedside and tucked one copy of the report, sealed in a manila envelope, under the edge of the blanket folded at his feet. On my way past the nurse's station, I had a quick chat with Miss Kovach, who told me he was being transferred out of CCU and onto a regular medical floor. I told her to tell him I'd been in and had left him an update at the foot of his bed.
"I'll be sure and tell him," she said.
As I eased out of the parking lot, Stacy was just pulling in. We both rolled down our windows and had a chat car to car. I passed him the second copy of the notes I'd typed, and included a quick account of my conversation with Adrian, plus the gossip I'd picked up from Betty Puckett regarding Wilbur Sanders's decampment and his subsequent bigamy. Stacy said,
"Sorry to hear Pudgy spent so much time at the McPhees. I hate rooting against the guy, but we could use a break about now."
So what if he knew them? He still could have stolen the car, don't you think?
"How are we going to prove it? I thought the prints would turn out to be significant," he said. "Oh, well, I'll ask the boys to get to work on Wilbur. Shouldn't be hard to track him down. Might as well cook his goose while we're at it."
"Yeah, Medora's in bad shape. It'd be nice to see him taking some responsibility. Meanwhile, where were you? I stopped by the motel and you were gone."
"I went over to the sheriff's office and talked to a couple of detectives. They said they'd take a set of elimination prints on the McPhees if I can talk them into it."
"You think they'll agree?"
"I can't think why not. By the way, I want you to go to the Baptist church with me. It's Easter, and Edna tells me the McPhees will all be there. Two services tomorrow, but I think the 9 o'clock's our best bet. Afterward, they're going back to Edna's for a big Sunday dinner. Easter, I bet she does a spiral-cut ham."
"What makes you say that?"
"She's just like my mother. We had ham every Easter, along with yams and green beans. We'll follow them to the house and have a quick chat with them while they're all there together."
"I don't know, Stacy. Maybe you should go alone. I'll only end up irritating Rule."
"I want you with me. I promise we'll keep it brief."
A car pulled up behind me, and the driver gave a quick, polite beep of his horn. I said, "I'll catch you later at the motel."
"Give me 15 minutes.
We ate supper in Dolan's room, which Stacy had by now adopted as his own. Both of us sat on the king-size bed, sharing a bucket of franchised fried chicken, mashed potatoes, gravy, and watery corn on the cob. Once we'd finished, I gathered the chicken bones, empty cartons, and used plasticware, and tossed everything in the trash. Stacy wanted me to stay and watch a movie, but I was ready for a break. I'm not accustomed to spending so much time in the company of others. "If you need me, I'll be in my room. Otherwise, I'll see you in the morning."
"Great. I'll knock on your door at 8. That'll give you time to shower and get dressed."
"Oh, shoot, I just remembered. The only thing I have with me are blue jeans."
"No problem. We don't have to go in. We can wait in the parking lot and follow them home."
"Why not go straight to the house?"
"What if they change their minds and decide to go out for Sunday lunch? This may be the only chance we have to talk to them together."
"You think she'd give up the chance to cook her big Easter dinner?"
"Probably not, but I want to see the congregation all dressed up," he said. "We used to do that as kids."
"You're not going to let me get out of this, are you?" He smiled benignly.
"Enjoy your evening."
Chapter 23. The phone was ringing as I unlocked my door. I dropped my bag and plucked the handset from the cradle on what must have been the fourth or fifth ring. A woman said,